Welcome once again to The Word on the Hills, with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer. Each week, we visit with a local author, get an introduction to their work, a glimpse into their lives, find out what prompts them to write, and give them an opportunity to read from their work. This week, we're very pleased to welcome Heidi Crute. Heidi is a business writer and lives in Campbellcroft. Heidi has been connecting the five essential dots of communication for employees, customers, and the community for more than 35 years. She retired from the corporate world 8 years ago, and now, as principal of Crute Communications, writes magazine articles, newsletters, brochures, annual reports, speeches, strategic plans, and more for various clients. Welcome, Heidi.
Thank you.
We've heard that you've spent many years connecting the five essential dots of communication. Could you tell us a little about that?
Sure. The five dots are really the most magical tool I've encountered in my time as a corporate writer, and I wish I could put it in the hands of anyone who writes for business or indeed for any purpose at all. I found them buried in a business book by Jim Schaefer. The book was called The Leadership Solution, and they appealed to me immediately, and I've been promoting them ever since. And the premise is that people need, consciously or subconsciously, five pieces of information before they can buy into what you're telling them or do what you want them to do. And if you miss one dot, there's a niggling below the surface disquietude that sometimes isn't adding up. People realize that they're not getting the full story. And so dot number one is the context. It's about giving your reader or your listener perspective on the big picture. It's the why. It gives people a reason to do something. You want readers to be able to say, well, that makes sense. I may not like what I'm being asked to do, but I certainly get why I'm being asked to do it. And dot number two is strategy. And in business, strategy equates to an organization's vision, mission, and their annual objectives. Employees, above many things, like consistency, and they like to know that what you're asking them to do is in keeping with what they've asked you to do in the past. And benefits, or WIFM, as it's known in the trade, W-I-I-F-M, what's in it for me, where me is the reader, that's dot number three. People are motivated by different things, so to connect the third dot, you need to address as many of the benefits to your readers as you possibly can, and it's a really critical dot, that one. Yeah. The fourth dot, once people know how they're going to benefit, they want to know exactly what they need to do or what they have to do differently. So the fourth dot is called role. People need to know how your message relates to their specific situation. And so you need to spell out the responsibilities and accountabilities for people. And finally, people usually need support in being able to do what you want them to do. So what information are you going to provide to your readers to support them in what you're asking them to do? What tools are you going to provide? What equipment? What technology? And what training? And so business documents, and indeed all kinds of writing, including letters to Santa Claus, they begin to write themselves once you know what those five dots are and what the information behind each dot is. It takes away all the fear, takes away all the confusion, and they don't have to even be in the order in which I've given them. You can mix them all up.
That's really interesting. It sounds as though it would be useful to all kinds of writers to use.
Definitely,
that.
Definitely, yes. Yes.
Been a corporate writer for a long time. What's it like to write for business? You're not afraid of it now because you've got your five
yes.
dots.
Let me just draw from the arsenal of five dots. Writing for business is both, it deals with the exhilarating and the mundane. I will say this about corporate writing, it does teach you discipline. It's very structured, it's very organized. There's a big emphasis on logic, a big emphasis on bridging between ideas and messages for a broad audience. It very much teaches you to get into the reader's shoes. But there is some opportunity for imagination, I think. You're always looking for a way to turn something dry into something that's palatable, something that appeals to the reader's self-interest. It really, I think writing for business pivots on knowing your reader, which differs from writing for yourself. Who is the customer that will read this article? What is the call to action? So forth.
So most corporate writing is aimed at a customer, is it? Rather than, it's not internal kind of
It's both.
Both.
It's really both. I wrote a lot for customers, but it's writing for employees as well and speaking to their interests.
Since you retired from the corporate world, you've been getting into creative nonfiction.
Yes, I have.
So what made you decide to take that road?
Well, it was fear that I was always afraid that business writing might have snuffed the creative writing right out of me for all time. Mm. As a little girl, I wrote creatively, and I had wanted to find my way back to that. I found it very difficult while steeped in corporate writing to imagine a fictional world or to imagine fictional characters. You get enough business writing about computers or life in a nursing home or health and safety challenges, and the creative writing feels very far away indeed. Mm-hmm. But then I took a free fall writing workshop at Hockley Valley in February of last winter, and that let a little light seep in. And also, I have very interesting family members. And I very much want to get some of those stories down before it's too late.
That sounds really fascinating. So could you read a piece of nonfiction now?
Love to. I don't have a title for this piece. I think it's going to be embedded in a book if I can get myself together. There came a defining moment when my grandfather, my opa, found himself on the toilet at Kennedy Lodge Nursing Home with me, his 20-year-old granddaughter, by his side, my hands behind my back, my eyes averted, wishing fervently that I could just disappear. I had pushed past fear and towering reluctance, breached every boundary of generational respect to put him there. "Hast du das gemacht?" he asked me, suddenly aware. "Did you do this?" Meaning, did you, my granddaughter, pull my pants down, expose me like a mother would a child, lower me onto this toilet, and then stand there, bearing witness to this most private of acts, bearing witness to my shame? Were you the one? Did you do this? I pulled his Alzheimer's disease up between us like a shield, trusting it to save me. "Nein," I replied, shaking my head vigorously. "No, not me." He stared at me a moment, lucid, but unable to absorb our reversal in roles, lapsed into the business at hand. I don't remember any more if I applied the toilet paper, which I would have done if I'd had to, or if I was finally able to rouse a harried staff member to help. I suspect it was the latter. Had it been the former, I would still be weeping to tell it. Those who live life soaring from peak to peak have a pitiable distance to fall. My opa was a giant among men, rakishly handsome, charismatic, with his thick black hair, one lock careless on his forehead, Elvis Presley mouth, blue eyes. Born in 1900 in Frankfurt, Germany, and emigrating to Canada by ship when he was 30, he had everything it took to survive as the Great Depression took its toll on families everywhere. He ate in soup kitchens in the beginning, eventually doing odd jobs as gardener, chauffeur, handyman, before finding work as a chef in the Royal Muskoka Hotel and then the Royal York Hotel in Toronto. He bought a farm in Freeman before showing an aptitude as a prospector, discovering gold mines in northeastern Ontario and eventually the world's largest nickel mine in Brazil, never developed because of its inaccessible location. The former Canadian mining company, Inco, was one of his partners, and the former Governor General, Roly Michener, one of his supporters and devoted fans. This was the man who sat on the toilet in front of me that day. This was the conqueror felled by malicious, invisible sorcerers at work in his brain, snipping, with their indiscriminate scissors, carving out vast and precious webs of memory, rewiring language, setting up impenetrable barriers preventing access to identity, dignity, self-esteem. But they forgot to dismantle the music. Opera had always been a mainstay of Opa's life, manifesting in a sacred ritual every Saturday afternoon when he would turn on the radio and listen to the Metropolitan Opera's live broadcast. One of the four children for whom that ritual became equally important was my mother. When she visited her father at Kennedy Lodge, she would play tapes of the operas he loved best. The effect was instantaneous, organic. The music rushed like a flood of warm milk through the ruined city of his mind, providing comfort, filling spaces, offering a touchstone, a place he recognized and loved. And the film over his eyes would clear and he would smile and sing, brandishing his hands as if he were a conductor, sitting on his pedestal in the orchestra pit, raising his baton, his daughter, his audience of one, her eyes shining, giving him no reason to doubt his undiminished power to lead. And why should he doubt? He knew himself as an entrepreneur who had made countless business trips to Brazil and other parts of the world, shaking hands, doing deals, scattering stardust, sometimes staying away for weeks at a time. When I was a child, my mother taught me to wave at every plane that thundered past. Opa might be in there. One Christmas Eve, his family prepared to celebrate without him. The Christmas tree lights were on, Santa had come. The presents were heaped under the tree. The house was filled with the savory smells of turkey and turnip, the windows frosted with steam, a fire in the grate, and Oma, my aunts, my uncle, all of us singing Christmas carols, Stille Nacht, Heilige Nacht, and O Tannenbaum, a ritual that preceded the opening of gifts in the living room, when from somewhere outside in the winter cold, a familiar voice chimed in, stopping the music in people's throats as they strained to listen, daring to hope it was true. And it was. It was Opa, Lord and Master, home from overseas in the nick of time to bring joy to his family by joining them for Christmas. He walked in the front door, seemingly on stilts, beaming, singing, his adoring family hanging on him like ribbons, kissing him, hugging him, shrieking with excitement as he bestowed on us a gift, his presence, unimagined and priceless. Until it happened exactly the same way next year.
Thank you. That was a lovely piece. We'll take a break now.